Welcome to Same Surgeon, Different Life, part of the STS Surgical Hot Topics podcast. This series focuses on demystifying cardiothoracic surgery and presenting the remarkable backstories of surgeons from a variety of backgrounds and in various career stages that have led them to become the face of CT surgery. I'm Dr. David Tom Cook, and in each episode, Dr. Tom Varghese and I will get to know more about our colleagues, the obstacles, the success stories, trade-offs, and pivotal moments that have shaped their careers as well as their personal missions. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. The program will return after a message from our sponsor.
The Society of Thoracic Surgeons Same Surgeon, Different Light podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, celebrating 25 years of creating innovative medicines and improving access to them.
Welcome to another episode of Same Surgeon, Different Light. I'm your host, Tom Varghese. Today, I am joined by a leading light in the field of cardiothoracic surgery, Dr. Richard Oye. Dr. Oye is the Associate Chair of the Department of Cardiac Surgery, the head of the Section of Pediatric Cardiovascular Surgery, and co-director of the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital Congenital Heart Center. A professor of cardiac surgery, his research interests are in clinical and translational research, and he is co-founder of the Michigan Congenital Heart Outcomes Research and Discovery, otherwise known as MCORD, program. His spectacular career is notable for several achievements, including study chair of a 15-center randomized trial comparing techniques for the Norwood operation for hypoplastic left heart syndrome, the first multi-institutional randomized clinical trial performed in congenital heart surgery. Rick was my program director at the time of graduation from the University of Michigan Cardiothoracic Surgery Fellowship. And for all of us as his trainees, Dr. Oye is one of the most grounded individuals you will ever meet. The traits of grounded leaders include being unshakable in the midst of a crisis, reliability, possessing an unwavering moral compass, humility, self-assurance, standing up for what's right, and encouraging others to succeed. Rick embodies these traits, and they served him well during two crises, which we talk about during today's interview. The tragic deaths that occurred on June 4th, 2007, when the University of Michigan Health System lost six heroes as their plane crashed into Lake Michigan after they had procured a pair of lungs for transplantation, a group that included my classmate and CT surgery fellow, Dr. David Ashburn, as well as his personal health crises after a carotid dissection. Join us as we reflect on his journey and his advice for all of us in our careers. Dr. Richard Oye on today's Same Surgeon, Different Light. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to see you.
It's great seeing you. For the listeners, full disclosure, when Dr. Oye took over as program director at the University of Michigan CT Surgery Training Program, I was his first class of graduates. And so we go back a long way. And it's amazing that Dr. Oye survived all these years despite having me as a trainee. So I appreciate all the support over the decades.
That was an experience. That's how you snuck through the door, I think.
Oh, there you go. That's great. Well, Dr. Oye, obviously this podcast is really dedicated to deep diving into the amazing and diverse lives of our practicing CT surgeons. So let's start off. Where did you grow up and where would you consider your hometown?
So I was born and raised in New Jersey. I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is where Rutgers is. So I was born at one of the hospitals there. After that, probably around first grade, I moved to a town called Berkeley Heights in New Jersey, which is, if you think of New Jersey kind of as a oblong state, it's about a third of the way down, about halfway between what would be New York City and say Allentown, Pennsylvania. Not off an exit. It was not really near the turnpike or the Guard State Parkway. Lived there, really same house all through all of my grade school and through high school. And then went to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Went to med school at Ohio State, stayed at Ohio State for general surgery. I did a couple years of transplant immunology research during that time. did my CT there as well, and then had the great fortune of doing my fellowship at Michigan, just like you, but mine was in teeth cardiac.
That's
surgery.
Amazing. But going back in time, I mean, did you know that when you went to Penn that you were definitely headed to med school? Like, where was that decision to pursue a medical career? Where did that come from?
Yeah, you know, I always knew I was going to be a surgeon, always. There was not something that happened. I didn't have an epiphany. I don't have any medical people in my family than my aunt's a nurse. I was always around science. My mom, although while we were young, was a stay-at-home mom. She had a degree in microbiology, and prior to getting married and having kids, had worked at Rockefeller Institute in New York City. So I was always sort of surrounded by science. You know, had that chemistry kit, you know, the metal chemistry kit, which dates me. It had all kinds of terribly dangerous chemicals, which I'm sure you can't sell anymore. And, you know, I always wanted to make the rocket with the bicarbonate. And, but my mom always made me do stuff like the paper chromatography. So I was sort of always around science, not medicine per se, but I always knew I was going to be a surgeon for as long as I can remember. Again, nothing particularly happened. I didn't break my leg and get taken care of with someone that looked like Robert Young, which also dates me. So anybody watching this, is probably very few people will get that reference, but you can Google it. Robert Young was a TV show. But I wasn't taken care of by some, you know, stereotypic white haired, you know, surgeon who fixed my leg. But I just sort of always knew I was going to be a surgeon from as long as I can remember.
And what about CT surgery and more specifically pediatric cardiac surgery? Because it's a very small, you know, hyper-focused, hyper-specialized subspecialty. Where did that decision come from?
Yeah, so when I kind of knew I was going to be a surgeon, like I said, and when I went to med school, I thought I wanted to do plastic surgery. So I'd done a lot of art and things like that when I was a kid. A lot of sort of fine detail stuff like those plastic models. And so I thought I was wanting to do plastic surgery. I thought I was going to do craniofacial reconstruction surgery. I thought, well, here's what I'm used to, what sort of my background is, if you will. I'm going to make faces for kids, you know, who have deformities, and that's what I'm going to do. So then when I went to start my internship, that was sort of my plan. In fact, I had the opportunity at the end of that year. They were just starting their I6 equivalent for plastic surgery, and they asked me if I wanted to join. But what had happened during that year, I did plastics, as we all did, rotated through all the different specialties. And when I rotated on plastics, I really liked the burn unit. Those patients were all super sick, and I enjoyed taking care of them. I didn't really enjoy the surgery. I don't have anything against aesthetic surgery or cosmetic surgery, and I enjoyed it, actually. But it wasn't perfect. I thought it was going to be, like I said, like art. But I don't know if you've ever seen a rhinoplasty, but, you know, they just take the rasp and they're like, well, that looks good. I think that's going to be okay. You know, like the incisions aren't necessarily perfect. And I remember one of the attendings saying, oh, that's, you know, it was like one side was slightly off. You know, it's like, he's like, it'll be okay. That'll go down. Or, you know, oh, that's okay. It'll come up. It's like, wait a second. This is not what I thought it was going to be. And then I rotated on cardiac. And then, you know, it was everything perfect. And, you know, this was, I don't know, 30 years ago. So there were a lot of the stereotypic cardiac surgeons, which some still exist, I admit. But it was, they were frankly inappropriate, abusive. And I don't espouse that, but they were also the hardest working surgeons I'd ever seen. You know, if we got out of the operating room at midnight, they were still there working. And I don't know if that's a good role model, but they were certainly hard, incredibly hardworking, worked almost as hard as we were. I mean, that was back in the days of everything at call, you know, so we were there in the hospital for 40 hours or 46 hours and, you know, home for 2 hours, or wouldn't even bother going home, but everything I call. And so we were working super hard, and I saw them working just as hard. They were in your face kind of individuals, but I respected that. I don't want someone going behind my back to my program director saying, hey, what's wrong with Rick? You know, they'd get in your face and say, what's wrong with you? And so I can, that sort of resonated with me. Maybe that's maybe that I'm a little twisted that way, I suppose. But that also appealed to me, the hard work. And then when I rotated on peds, then it was like another level of everything perfect. And I was like, this is what I want to do. This is super duper hard. Every stitch has to be perfect. And I had found my niche.
I mean, the thing that's always impressed me about pediatric cardiac surgery specifically is a couple of themes picking up on what you said. It is art. I mean, it is taking this precious child that's in front of you who's got imperfect anatomy, and you're trying to remodel or trying to figure out how best to salvage a situation, you know, and you're right. I mean, but the 3D visualization, it seems like that seems to be a superpower of our pediatric cardiac surgeons. When did you realize that you actually had that superpower? Or you're able to kind of visualize what the potential solution could be in 3D.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I'll just as background, you know, because residents will say to me, you know, how do I know if I'm that good? And I don't know if you know inherently. Like, you asked me, when did you know? I don't think I ever knew per se. You know, I think I was a pretty good surgical resident and got, you know, good evaluations about my technical abilities. So I knew I had certain inherent technical skills. You know, my hands were attached to my brain, all those important things. So I knew I was a good technical surgeon, but I don't think at the time I realized the importance of being able to see in three dimensions. But now, like I said, I think you're spot on when people ask me about it. You know, how do you know whether there are people that want to do this or just lay people? You know, how do you separate the residents? I mean, I've had, 30 fellows. And you can see that some are just absolutely different than others. People like Jenna Romano, you know, she's different. Vic Sue, Tim Lancaster, my other two partners, they're different, and you can see it almost immediately. I mean, Jenna, as a resident, I took her through a 3-month-old co-arc as a third year general surgery resident because she was that good. And you could just recognize it even at that stage of her career. And but to get back to the three dimensions, how I describe it, I say, you know, I can tell you, listen, if I have to make this complex pathway from a remote VSD, you know, around the tricuspid valve, around the pulmonary valve up to the aorta, and I have to just start with a flat piece of cortex and I have to cut it into this crazy shape and then I have to sew it in, it's got to be perfect every time. Perfect. And I can tell you, you know, well, if I take the bite here too much and I shorten that or spread it out too much, see how it's going to flatten the patch. And so I have to not, the temptation is like, oh, I'm going to make it really wide because wide is better. But as you get too wide, the patch gets flat and it comes like a drum head. And I can describe that and people will understand it. But the people that really get it, see it like a CAD drawing. I mean, they see it in three dimensions and they're flying through it. They're taking this thing and they're rotating it around and they're flying through the tunnel. And it is exactly what you said. It's that ability to see in three dimensions. And more recently, I saw a Grand Rounds that was talking a lot about that, the ability to see and think in three dimensions as pertains to surgery. But I think you're absolutely right. That's what sets the really good technical surgeons apart from the people that are really good congenital heart surgeons.
Amazing. Now, I think that what I want to do is pivot a little bit to the next part of your career. Yeah, you know, it is a program director of a storied fellowship. Did you know that that was always in your cards? Like, was that part of your longitudinal planning in your career? Was that something where the opportunity came and you just capitalized on that?
I think it came, it sort of developed over time. I don't think I ever thought of myself as being a super successful academic surgeon. You know, I always thought I was just, you know, another guy who wanted to do surgery and I wanted to do good surgery. But my academic part of my career certainly evolved over time. A great mentorship, Terry Davis, who was the head of Pete's cardiac at Columbus Children's, which is now nationwide, at Beauvais. You know, they were great mentors. And so I learned a lot about mentorship and the importance of it. And so I'll expand sort of program directorship into just mentorship in general. And it's incredibly rewarding for me personally. So I do it and you might say, oh, that's great. You know, being a program director and putting your time in and taking time to do a mentorship, be a mentor. But it is, to me, one of the most rewarding parts of my career. The fellow from CHOP who just graduated in congenital heart surgery, Garrett Coyne, he was one of my freshman mentees at Michigan. Wow. So I used to do freshman mentoring. So they'd give me like 10 freshmen that were just matriculating into Michigan and that self-identified as wanting to do medicine. And, you know, I'd take them around and have them at my house and feed them. And I would have different physicians, all different specialties, talk to them and that sort of thing. But Garrett is, he's a great, great person. He's from a little town in Kansas. He didn't even know pediatric cardiac surgery existed. Like first person in his family to go to college. And to see him now so many years later, actually graduating as a congenital heart surgeon, is pretty amazing. And that same year, the graduate from Cincinnati also I mentored when he was an undergraduate. And it's humbling to read, say, that kid's personal statement. And he says, literally, it said, you know, then I saw a lecture by Dr. Richard Oye and it changed my life. You know, the impact that you can have on people is just incredible. I mean, I've got people that were high school students that came and shadowed me and now are in medicine. I'll tell you one other quick story. You'll be afraid to ask me too many questions because I'll keep talking.
No, go for it.
So I'm down getting my fit testing, you know, our N95 masks. You got to do that every year. And so I'm down doing my fit testing. And so as I'm sitting there waiting my turn, a young female physician comes out of the fit testing area and she says, Dr. Oye? And I said, yes. And she said, I'm so-and-so. I said, you probably don't remember. I said, yes, you were an undergrad. You used to shadow me. And I said, I remember your sister who shadowed me a lot more, Megan. And she says to me, she said, well, we're both physicians now. She said, Megan
Incredible.
Is a hospitalist at St. Joe's, which is, as you know, the community hospital in Ann Arbor. And she said, I work here at Student Health. And she says to me, and you could see, and it even makes me emotional, you could see it almost choked her up to say to me, she said, I really want you to know that I have my own freshman mentees now. And, Beautiful. You know, it's the paying it forward. She's because it had
Absolutely
such amazing. An impact on her. I mean, you could see just the pride and emotion she had just to be able to run to me and say, I want you to know that I have freshman mentees now, too. So, I mean, it's people think it's selfless or whatever, but it pays back tenfold what you put into it for sure.
Incredible. Well, I did want to approach one aspect. I mean, knowing who all the graduates from the University of Michigan have been having over the years, I can categorically say we are not clones of each other. and I think you can appreciate that as well. I mean, and it's incredible just to see how wildly successful the graduates from the training program have been over the years. What has been your approach? I mean, or your favorite strategy to use when you're dealing with so many driven but completely different personalities and individuals who are driven in various different categories?
Yeah, I think there's two things. One, I mean, everybody has their strengths and their weaknesses, and I think you have to know them. But I think more importantly, you have to have them understand what they are, and not everybody has to become you, right? A super duper successful academic surgeon. That's not everybody's desire or their skill set, and so I think you have to sort of understand each person as an individual, where they are, whether it's professionally or technically or personally, you know, what their goals are. There are some people where there's a mismatch, you know, they don't have the technical skill. And that's one thing I swore. I saw, you know, in general surgery, people getting passed through that, you know, you knew they were not going to succeed, but they got passed through. And I swore I would never, ever, ever do that. And there's been a few occasions where I've had some very difficult conversations with people, you know, oh, you know, your lifelong dream that you've had since you were eight, I'm going to tell you that that's a mistake. And so I think that you need to recognize people's strengths as well as their weaknesses, understand them overall from a personal standpoint as well as a professional standpoint to help guide them. That's the first part of it. The second part of it is, I think that you have to remain present. You know, I still mentor a lot of our fellows. I'm sure I talk to at least one of them every week about whether it's a case, it may be something more straightforward, or it may be career oriented. So I think it's also a long-term commitment and not just, they're under your tutelage, because it's tough out there. I don't know. I think adult, but I think congenital is pretty tough. There's not a lot of really good jobs out there.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lifelong commitment.
And I think that going along with that in terms of dealing with unexpected events. So for the listeners, in my final year of training, Dr. Oye was our program director. We had a tragedy beyond, completely unexpected. It was my classmate, Dr. David Ashburn, who tragically died in the organ procurement events. That is, this was a team that flown to Milwaukee to procure a set of lungs, and on the way back, the plane crashed. And in my last month of training, obviously, losing somebody as close as your classmate in a class, and then going to multiple funerals because everybody in the plane didn't survive, dealing with that. And of course, Rick, you're the program director at that point. Could you just briefly talk about how to deal with that completely unexpected event? And obviously, it's an event that's impacted all of us decades later. We still think about David and Richard and Martin and all the others who passed away on that plane. Could you talk us through your thought processes at the time of just dealing with that and then managing the expectations afterwards?
Yeah, so obviously that was really horrible. Just a little more background. You know, David was going to do congenital. He was about to start our fellowship a few weeks after the event. And by the way, he's a guy who had it. I mean, he was a phenomenal technical surgeon and would have been an amazing congenital heart surgeon. Now, there's no roadmap to deal with it, whether it's personally or professionally. I mean, it's still a little hard for me to talk about, you support not only your residents and your fellows within your program, but the families. They need more support than anybody. And, so we had to do a lot of that as well. I was already pretty close with Candace, David's wife, and got to be very close with his parents. I still keep in touch with them. I don't know that there was any magic to it. In fact, because there is no good answer. I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's like when we talk to our patients' families when they pass away. I mean, there's no magic word. There's no magic thing that you can say or do that's going to make it at all better. I think you just need to be there to support each person. Not unlike mentorship. I mean, each person's going to need something different. Some people don't need very much at all, and some people need a lot of support. So I think there's a little bit of analogy there. I mean, you just have to meet people with where they are and what they need. But I don't know that there's lessons to be learned per se, because I don't think you can possibly have a disaster plan for something like that.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you taking the time. And I know that you're right. I mean, all of us, I mean, we still think about David and the entire crew each and every single day. I mean, Rick, you and I have had that conversation every single time I go on a flight. It's one of the first thoughts I think about as well. But I do appreciate, one of the things that I'm eternally grateful for was that Candace insisted that we have a graduation event that year. And so the three of us who were in the graduating class, where it was David, myself and then Matt Romano, you know, Jenna's husband. It was the three of us who were the graduating class. And I will be honest, Matt and I initially thought there's no way we can have a graduation event without David. There's no, I mean, we were inclined to cancel it, but until Candace insisted, said, no, this is, we need to celebrate his life and we need to come together. And it was probably one of the most raw and emotional graduation events I've ever been a part of. And I can only imagine you as a program director at that time, Rick, tried to be the master of ceremonies of this event. But I think decades later, I'm eternally grateful for everybody, to Candace and the entire Michigan family, for going forward with that event on that day.
Yeah, Candace is a woman of incredible strength and incredible faith that carries her, as is the rest of her family and David's family. So I think in her mind, this was David's graduation. I mean, just because he wasn't there, he was still going to graduate. And he did. And he graduated with you and Matt, and Candace received his diploma and the other things that go with it, the chair, of course. Yeah. No, I think that it would have been just as difficult not to have something. Glad for the way that worked out.
So really going from one challenging conversation to put you on the spot with another, wildly successful, internationally known pediatric cardiac surgeon at the echelon of any academic achievements you can think about. But then you had to deal with your own health issues. Talk to us about what happened and how you went about dealing with that.
Yeah. So what Tom is talking about is I was playing hockey and I tore my carotid, got a carotid dissection. And what happens is not only do you tear your carotid and potentially have a occlusion of blood flow, but clot forms on the tear and that flicks downstream. So kind of a long story, but so I was out there at a clinic playing, and truth be told, the tear probably started because I had been really sick the week before and coughing really hard. In fact, because you can actually tear your carotid coughing. That's one of the etiologies of carotid dissections. And so, and my wife even said to me that week, she said, I've never seen you cough like this before in your life. And so then I would go out and I would play hockey at this morning clinic, and I start getting this visual aura, and I had like one migraine in my life, and it started with a visual aura, and I was like, can't believe I'm getting a migraine. I'm going to play hockey in 2 weeks, and I really want to be out here. So I get in this visual migraine, what I thought was a visual migraine, but I keep skating. And then finally we get to this one drill, and I'm seeing two pucks. And so I close one eye and I finish the drill. And then I'm like, what are you doing? you want to play hockey so bad, you're going to do it with one eye shut. And by then I was having this excruciating headache, which, ischemia doesn't cause pain. It must've been from the dissection, and it's so bad. I come off the ice. I call my wife. I'm like, listen, you need to come get me. Cause I said, I'm having such a bad migraine, I don't think I can drive home. And I said, I don't even think I can get my gear off. So you're going to need to come in and help me get my gear off. So I go back to the locker room and I'm like, my head's hurting so bad, I've thrown up in the garbage can. And, I managed to start taking my gear off, and in retrospect, I sort of fell over to my left side, and I just thought it was because I was in so much pain and I was so nauseous, but I ended up getting my gear off. I meet my wife, so she drives me home. We leave my car there at Yost, the ice arena here, and I'm like, listen, I was like, thank goodness I don't have a case today. So I'm like, listen, I'm going to go to bed and just try to sleep this off.
So at this time, you're still not registering how serious.
No, I'm still thinking I'm having the worst migraine of my life.
Wow.
And so she's like, all right. So she calls up one of our neighbors and says, happens to be the wife of John Sharpie. You know, John.
I know John well. Yes.
Yeah. He's the head of pediatric cardiology here. So she calls Kathy, her best friend. She's like, hey, look, Rick, blah, blah, blah. Can you take me to get his car? So she's about to leave. And she's like, something didn't sit right with me. She's like, I've never heard you complain about anything. You never complained about pain in our 20 some years of marriage. And she said, I decided I better check on you one more time. So she comes upstairs and she sees me laying in bed and one of our dogs is laying next to me. And she said she could see me trying to pet the dog, but I'm like trying to flip my left arm up. I'm not lifting it. I'm sort of using my body to flip my arm up on the dog. Oh. And then in this sort of fog, I hear her say to Kathy, she's like, should I call 911? And I hear Kathy say, yes. Next thing I know, I'm an ambulance on the way. And I'm still thinking I'm having a migraine. And I get to the ER and the neurology fellow is there. And she asked me, you know, alert Norwich times three. And I got the date wrong. And she said, would it surprise you if I told you this was Wednesday? I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. Because yesterday I did a, you know, whatever, BSD, and it was Tuesday. And then they wheel me off into the scanner. I did get a CT and an MR. And as I'm wheeling out, I hear somebody say, he's got a carotid dissection. I'm like, what do you mean I got a carotid dissection? I'm like, having a migraine here, not a carotid dissection. And by this time, I'm starting to get pretty out of it. And I could sort of hear people talking, and I was talking, but it was still like in this huge fog. And so basically, my entire MCA on my right side was out. I mean, if you look at my MRI, it's horrifying. I mean, there's just like this big black strip right here. And now I'm coming hemiparetic. And so by now, John had arrived. And so they had given me a bolus of TPA when I first arrived because they thought I was having an embolic stroke. And so they said, listen, you know, normal treatment for this is you just have to wait it out and see what's left. And he said, well, you know, we're starting to sort of stent some of these things. And the neurosurgeon and the interventional radiologist was like, we can stent this. And the neurologist was like, no way. You just gave him a bolus of TPA. And so they asked Bonnie, you know, what do you want to do? And she said, I tried to think about what you would want to do and you would want to be aggressive. And then John was there to support her. And she said, okay, take him. So one did the, got my carotid stents. Is really is a whole lot.
So at the time they're having this conversation about whether to stent or not, were you like aware enough?
I wasn't a part of that conversation. Yeah. But I remember the stenting because I'm a pretty stoic guy. And they did it with no sedation. And I'm laying there. And
wow.
You know, even though I was in a fog, it sucked. Totally sucked. Because what they have to do before they deploy the stents, they have to suck the clot off of them. Because if they deploy the stents with all the clot there,
it showers everywhere.
All the clot showers downstream. So every time they went up there and they just take a syringe, and I could hear it. I could hear them go, oh, you know, you're thinking, wow, I hope a piece of clot doesn't go fly off downstream because that's end of the story. And, you know, so I'm laying there listening to this, and again, I don't want to get too dramatic, but you got a lot of time, a couple hours laying on your back, trying to stay perfectly still to think about the last thing you said to me, my two daughters, last thing you said to your wife. Because again, if one of those doesn't get the clot, you know, it could be bad. And same thing when they deployed the stents, they're like, okay, we're going to deploy the stent. I was like, well, if they lose the stent, you know, it's going to be game over. And they deploy it. And then I hear them say, well, all right, well, let's try another one.
Oh,
great.
Hey, and you're hearing all this. One. Wow.
Like, what do you mean? You have to try another one. So then they get it. They get it put in. Oh, the other thing that's sort of funny, they're like, okay, we got it. We're getting ready to do the stents. They're like, okay, put his NG down and give him his aspirin. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, I'm awake here.
I can take the aspirin. Just give it to
me. Even though I was in this like total fog, I'm like, oh, no NG, please. I'm like, I can take this with like a sip of water. So they gave me a bunch of aspirin. I got to chew them up and swallow them down. So it was quite an experience. But then by 8:30 or so, the repeat MRI showed reperfusion of my MCA, but I was hemiparetic for a period of time, and it sort of slowly came back. I have a little bit of a tiny bit of residual weakness and numbness in these fingers. It's really weird that I can have motor and sensory in an ulnar distribution, but it's central, which doesn't make any sense for you budding neurologists and neurosurgeons out there. It doesn't make sense to have peripheral distribution from a central lesion that's in your motor cortex, But my stroke neurologist said he'd seen it before, but it makes absolutely no sense to have motor intensity in an
ulcer. I mean, I can't even imagine all the emotions and everything you're processing at that point, because obviously probably one of the first thoughts that came to your mind was, is this the end of my career? Correct?
No, I never thought about it. I was out of it enough. And, you know, I mean, for me, I mean, you know me, my career doesn't define me. I'm not going to be one of these people that are going to be doing this at 80. You know, as soon as my financial guy says I can go, I'm out. I got a lot of other interests. So actually that never bothered me. And wow. The recovery was long. It was, weird. I mean, there was all kinds of,
so what, was it like happened. Extensive physical therapy, occupational therapy? I mean, what was the recovery like?
Somewhat. I mean, a lot of it was just rest. You know, at first it's a brain injury. So, you know, and the swelling that goes with having no blood supply to part of your brain for, you know, 12 hours. I guess it wasn't 12 hours, but maybe 4 or 5 hours. And so initially I couldn't really do anything much. I guess the good example is maybe after a week or two, I could start doing some emails. And so I would do literally one email and then have to sleep for 2 hours. And wow. Then I'd get up, I'd do another email and sleep for 2 hours. So it was a fair recovery, probably a couple months until I felt pretty normal-ish. Fortunately or unfortunately, I guess, I have some friends in the military who've been blown up and have TBI. And I was talking to one of them. He's like, don't worry, man. He's like, it's going to get better. You know, it will come back. It's just going to take time. So a lot of it was time. Yes, I did some physical therapy for this. Most of the rest of it came back. I had another clot that went to my occipital cortex, my visual cortex. And I had initially a field defect, but that slowly went away that was pretty quick, actually, probably over about 10 days. But I never really thought about, you know, does this mean the end of my career? You know, there's what wasn't really an issue for me personally, but I can see how for a lot of other people it might be. So I got pretty good disability insurance, so I figured I'd be okay.
Well, I guess so, Rick, one of the things that one of many things I've always admired about you is balance. Like you're wildly successful in your professional life, but I would make the argument that you're even more successful in your personal life. I mean, amazing wife, kids, family. But I remember all along that you are very intentional about getting balance in your life, in the sense that when you're working hard, you're working hard. But as you correctly pointed out, hockey is one of the activities that you do, and you have great friends and networks outside of work. When did that come about? Like, did you always, were you very intentional about that, like throughout training?
Yeah, and your career? I think there are some things that I think that you say are true. I have circles of friends outside of medicine for sure. I do have a great wife and two great daughters, and that's probably credit to her and less to me. I would agree that I've always been very intentional. I would disagree that I always have had good balance. I would say I wish I had spent more time at home. I don't beat myself up about it too much, because that's just not how it was. You know, 25 years ago when I started, that wasn't really an option.
Right.
To get to where I'm sitting literally and figuratively right now, that wasn't really an option. You couldn't say, oh, I'm just going to work 60% or 80%. Like I said, I don't beat myself up about it, but I wouldn't say I had great balance in the sense of what we think of it now, having time balance. I do agree that, and this is what I tell people, undergrads or whoever, or med students, about being intentional. You need to be aware of your compromises, because there will be compromises, and you have to choose what your compromises are. You can't let them choose you, and you can't, and you have to make sure your family is on board with your sacrifices. And I think that is really important. I really like the word intentional that you used. And I think that's really, really important. because you will have compromises. And if you're not aware with about them, or you don't accept them, and your family doesn't accept them, it's going to be unhappy for everybody. I've missed a lot of stuff from my kids growing up, but the only things that really upset me is when I thought I was going to make something and I didn't make it. You know, I'm like, okay, I got this planned out. I should be done by 6 o'clock. I'm going to jump in my car and I'm going to make my daughter's recital. And then you don't make it. And so that's, and if you're not intentional, that's going to happen all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree with what you said, except for I'm not sure I'm the poster child for balance, especially early on in my career. I am pretty good about it now. But,
well, I mean, from my personal perspective, you were one of the first faculty members that I saw being, you know, trying to do things outside of work. And it's not to say that, you know, I've been doing this long enough now, I've got lots and lots of models, but at least in training, as you correctly pointed out, in the era that we all trained, we only saw one model, that was work all the time. We didn't see people doing activities outside of work. Now, of course, it's great that we talk about it, and especially our younger generations are so in tune to making sure that, you know, there's a lot of aspects of life. It's not just your professional career, but for me, it was eye-opening. And so,
thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I tried to do what I could when I was home. And I can't say that I was home a ton, but when I did, I tried to be engaged. I remember I'll tell you one funny anecdote. My wife's triathlete, she's an Ironman, and she was going to do a race, and our kids were super young. They were probably, I don't know, 2 or 3, something like that. And so she was out doing some race. And so I show up with, and our kids are like 12 months apart. So they're really close in age, 2 girls. And so I come up pushing the double stroller, and the girls are all in their matching outfits. Their hair is done. I've done their hair matching with braids and everything like that. And as I pull up, Bonnie said, one of the other women said to her, "Is Rick a stay-at-home dad?" Showed up with the kids like all dressed up in their with their hair done and everything like that at whatever 8 in the morning, and race. That's pretty funny. So maybe I did okay with the times I was home, but I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, in the time we have left, I mean, for the listeners, Rick and I could be swapping stories. We could spend all day, but with the time we have left, you've had a lot of amazing things happen in your career. And taking a reflection back, understanding that a good chunk of our listeners are our future generation, you know, students who are thinking about CT surgery, people currently in training, young attendings. Any pearls of wisdom that you have in terms of reflecting about it in the amazing life that you lived and things that even that may have been brought up in our conversation today? Any pieces of advice for them?
I don't know what's advice, but I think you need to look at what we do as an honor. You know, for me in particular, I'm taking care of people's children. You know, that's a tremendous honor to be able to care for any patient. And I do think it's a little bit greater, but I think to remember that what we are allowed to do is an honor to be able to care for people. It's a privilege to be able to care for people. You know, when I talk to, you know, Alpha Epsilon Delta or medical fraternity sorority here, and I think it's an undergraduate, but anyway, it's the medical group. And, I try to describe to them what that means. And I think it's really difficult. But it's a truth. And I think people need to remember that. I always tell them this story. I say, well, listen, I said, a lot of you don't have kids, so it's even hard to understand. But what if your parents, I had said to them, I want you to take all your life savings. I want you to take everything that you've saved, your entire life, your savings, the deed to your house, your cars, and I want you to put it in a briefcase, one of those metal silver briefcases, and I want you to bring it to me tomorrow morning. And I'm going to take that and I'm going to hold it for 5 hours and I'm going to take super good care of it. And at the end of 5 hours, I'll bring it back to you. They'd be like, what are you kidding me? They'd be like, no way. I'm not giving you my entire worth to have and hold for 5 hours. But they're going to do that with their child, which they would trade that all their wealth for in a second for that child's health. But they're going to give you something even greater than that. And so that's kind of how I try to describe it to them. But I think the most important things to remember are that it is an honor to do what we do, and you should be very grateful for what you're allowed to do. I do like a lot, again, the idea of being intentional with your life. You know, that's more advice. That would be more on the realm of advice, like you asked for. But just be aware of what you're doing. You know, now we would call it being mindful, I suppose. But back when I first started 25 years ago, it was more like just be aware of what your compromises are and what's going on around you, and don't get too caught up in what you're doing. You know, and do, like in today's world, it's different. Do maintain a balance. And again, be honest about yourself, honest with yourself about what you want to do, and decide where your compromises are going to be, because you can't do it all. That's for sure.
So, it's so powerful and absolutely amazing. No, I appreciate that analogy. Rick, as always, thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining us today on today's podcast, for sharing the incredible life lessons that you've learned along the way. And on behalf of all of our listeners, we really deeply appreciate it. And of course, as always, go blue.
Yeah, that's right. We got a big game tonight.
Game tonight for the listeners. We're doing this recording on the eve of the national championship game. So we know where our hearts are. So really appreciate you joining us today, Rick. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. All right. Have a great day.
This has been Same Surgeon, Different Life, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate it 5 stars and let your friends, trainees, and colleagues know about it. On social media, you can use the hashtag #TheFaceOfCTSurgery. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org.